Hi, I'm Danny Elfman.
This is Shirley Manson.
This is Debbie Harry.
This is Chris Steyer Blondie.
This is Ronan Dorzabal from Tears for Fears.
This is Billy Idol.
This is Alex Ebert, a.k.a. Edward Sharp, giving the story behind the song.
Hi, this is Peter Chotti, host of The Story Behind the Song. Each month I speak to some of music's biggest artists to get the inside stories behind their most lasting and iconic songs. Join me for new episodes on the third Monday of every month on The Story Behind the Song from the Consequence Podcast Network, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, pod people, Engineer Adam here, jumping in for a quick second to let you know about the brand new all-in-one platform for all of you creative podcasters out there. Anchor makes it easier than ever to make a podcast. It's free to use and has all the creation tools you need to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. Plus, Anchor will get your podcast set up on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are found. Even better, Anchor helps you connect with sponsors, even if you're just starting out. It's the perfect choice for podcasters, so make sure to check it out. Download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started. That's anchor.fm. Back to the show.
There is a podcast that is a world unto itself.
A podcast as boundless as space and as timeless as infinity.
It is the place between light and shadow.
Science and superstition.
You've entered the fifth dimension. The latest series from the Consequence Podcast Network will open the door into Jordan Peele's new revival of The Twilight Zone, and it will go as far as the limits of the mind itself. Subscribe to the fifth dimension.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hello to all of you pod people out there, pretty pod peoples. I'm your host, Leo Phillips, and this is another edition of This Must Be The Gig, your little backstage pass to the world of live music. Each and every week, I strive, I sweat, I labor to bring you a fascinating conversation from the beating heart of the live music and performance scene. And that could really mean chatting to a musician or a festival founder, a choreographer, a comedian, an actor, really anyone just as obsessed with performance in the way that we are. But before we dig into this week's fascinating interview, let's check in with our constant companion here at TMBTG Studios, Giggle Giggle Engineer Adam. Hello!
Hey! It's episode 50. 50! 5-0. Can you
For
believe it?
For these Bravo fans, it's episode 50.
It's episode 50 states.
It's episode 50 gates of wisdom, or 50 gates of impurity in Kabbalah.
It's episode 50 first dates.
It's episode 5th, the magic number in nuclear physics.
It's episode 50 million dollars, which is what we deserve for doing this podcast.
It's episode Canadian brand of beer called 50 Ale, created in 1950 by Labatt Breweries to commemorate 50 years of partnership.
I'm beginning to think you did a little more research than I did
this week. It's episode 5-0, slang for police officers and or warning that police are approaching.
And by research, I mean maybe printed out Wikipedia.
It's 50, which is the speed limit in kilometers per hour of Australian and Canadian roads with unspecified limits.
Wait, are you serious?
Yeah, wow.
Oh, wow. Hey, how about that?
It's episode 50 in the 1994 action movie Speed, which depicts a Los Angeles cop, Keanu, our babe, Keanu Reeves, who must rescue civilians on a bus that has a bomb rigged to it, which will detonate if the bus's speed drops below episode 50 miles per hour.
So basically what we're saying is we've done this for 50 episodes now.
We've done this exact bit.
Yes.
For 50 episodes. Absolutely. Talk to me.
I just want to say it's been an absolute honor working on this podcast with you.
Oh, that's really kind. I wasn't expecting that.
Yeah, no, I feel like this is a good celebration of all of the incredible work you do as...
And you?
The best interviewer in the game. I'm saying it.
Best engineer in the game.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
just so you know, in case you're one of those listeners that hasn't heard all 49 previous episodes, you got a lot of catching up to do.
I can't believe we're on 50.
I know, it's...
What a brilliant milestone.
I know.
It feels like we've gotten really far, but also, where are we? You know?
Because we started hitting it out of the park at the very beginning. You've got episodes
who
with...
Who was in the park? With, who is hitting?
You're hitting. You're hitting the interview out of the park.
Interview in the park. I like my things contained.
Well, you like to keep it contained, but contained in these past 49 episodes, you've got interviews with David Byrne,
great
Shirley Manson, Johnny Marr, John Darnielle, Jamila Woods,
Zola Jesus, Natalie Press. We've had a good run.
Yeah, there's some really incredible episodes back there in the backlog, which are all still available. So if this is your first episode, go back and listen to them all. And while you're on your phone searching for those episodes, leave us a note about how much you're enjoying it at TMBTGpod, TMBTGpod. That's Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. Find it all there. Better yet.
Although we have to be honest.
Yes. What are we honest?
We don't post on Twitter.
Or Instagram very much.
But
you could still message
us. You can still message us. And you can find me at Lior Phillips.
That's a better way to find
us
too.
And you can email us, which we've been getting so many emails lately.
Yes, it's been a real uptick.
It's been a real uptick. The email is thismustbethegig@gmail.com.
So message us there if you want to recommend a guest, if you want to tell us about your favorite concert. But even better... Tell us about your favorite concert experience by leaving it as a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts. Mm-hmm. That could be Apple Podcasts. It could be Spotify. It could be Stitcher. We're everywhere, baby.
I hope, you know, again, I think I might have mentioned this last time. Like, I hope that we don't die in this moment because
yeah,
that's
that would be the last thing I said.
Last thing
yeah.
You say, you must always be careful. Of your lasting words.
I say baby too.
I say baby too.
So each week we've been giving a shout out to someone that's left us an amazing review.
To embarrass everybody.
I think we should start reading the review itself so I can embarrass you a little bit.
Oh, Lord.
How would you like that?
Okay.
This one, ooh. This week's shout out goes out to Rary. I'm hoping I'm pronouncing that right. Rarry in the UK, who had this wonderful note.
Oh, I'm scared.
Genuinely my favorite interviewer, host, podcast person of all time.
Not talking about me. Must be not talking about me.
The funniest, most natural and informative podcast. I feel like I've stumbled across gold. Thank you. Make 100 more and then some more after that, please.
Whoa.
Those are some incredibly kind
they
words
are,
of support.
And guess what, Rary? We're halfway there.
We are halfway to Rary's goal of 100 episodes to listen to, so we got to keep going just for Rary.
But let's return the attention because it feels too overwhelming. Let's return the attention to this week's incredible chat. It's our first report from the heart of Moogfest, which everybody now knows and should know already. It is in Durham, North Carolina. It's this little festival that celebrates all things Moog and electronics, and it is covering a lot of newly built things on site and people's fixation with how things are made, what artists use on stage, how far they can take technology and the existential link between technology and performance. And to kick off our coverage and also to celebrate our 50, I couldn't have asked for another better guest. We've got an interview with the ever vibrant and continuously fascinating, passionate, and powerful Madam Gandhi, who is a force when you are around her. I think we giggled around Durham for probably 2 hours. I was locked into an honest-to-God vault with this activist and musician and artist, Kiran Gandhi. It was enlightening and inspiring and sweet and super interesting. And we joined occasionally on mic by her partner, Michelle, who was just the loveliest being in the world. And I loved hanging out with the two of them. We dug into Kieran's feminist activism, including her Future is Female playlist, which features exciting up-and-coming female-identifying artists, as well as her free menstruating run through the London Marathon. We chatted all about that. And also her experience drumming live for MIA, TV on the Radio, and Thievery Corporation, three gargantuan bands that have been very formative in my own music fandom. And growing up between New York and India, and the mystic depth of astrology, which we got to geek out over and hold each other's hands and be very, very present with us all, because it was a huge honor and blessing to be able to share an hour with somebody like this, and also to challenge things, which I feel is so often overlooked.
Absolutely.
Sometimes a person, you'll have a conversation with someone and they're not really open to challenging themselves
or
being
present.
Challenged or being present.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking about mindfulness. I'm speaking of listening, interacting, going through a mind map, and working out a puzzle through that, and reflecting on the industry from a perspective that she comes from, which is activism and performance, which is so magnetic. But let us not be delayed. Happy 50, everybody. This is me and Madam Gandhi. Enjoy.
I feel like I've known you for years.
I also feel weird suddenly holding a microphone, because maybe we should give some context. So for the last hour, we have been giggling in the windy city of Durham. Is that how you describe it?
No. Definitely. It was windy.
It's kind of strangely, but do you get affected by the wind? I feel very affected by the wind.
I do, like sniffly and like, yeah, for sure.
Also emotionally, I feel like everybody's issues just get blown around.
Wow.
And I feel...
That's profound.
Yeah.
We were just been laughing for the past hour about the water sign trifecta that we are. I had my girlfriend Michelle sitting next to me. We were eating some food, and then Lior came and joined and sat down. And then instantly, after 5 minutes of hanging out, I guessed accurately that she was a Scorpio.
I hate that it was accurate, but I kind of feel
understood.
I'm proud. Yeah. Because, you know, the thing about a Scorpio is that you also don't want to be found out. So, like, there's so much about me that's a private, not mysterious, private.
Mm.
And I feel like I'm okay with you knowing, you know?
Oh, I appreciate that.
I'm okay. After 5 minutes.
That's very sweet. Yeah. So we had I rep the Pisces. Michelle was repping the Cancer. And then we had Lior repping the Scorpio. And we were just bonding and laughing over that.
And if you don't believe about star signs...
Mm.
To the invisible audience that we are chatting to now, then you should start reading up about it. It's so accurate.
It is. It's really interesting. I think for me, it's the pattern recognition of it.
Yeah.
Just like for how much as a reporter you must travel, and as a musician I travel, I've found that every day I'm with new people, and there's just something very grounding, and it's sort of a really tiny entry point into someone's personality.
It's so true.
And it's definitely not the big picture. You know, the energies manifest themselves in really different ways, but I've always loved having the empathy of understanding where someone else is coming from, just from a little bit of that shape of their personality.
Yeah, especially when you're meeting new people, having familiarity is so important, because familiarity, there's something homely about it, and connecting. And I feel like that's also weirdly to go back to your music, you humanize your art. Your art is part of you. It's not separate.
Completely correct.
And I feel like just connecting with you for, you know, the last hour, it feels exactly like it does listening to your music, to be honest.
That's a really...
Obviously much more intensified, more powerful, but there's something so human about what you do. And that sounds so elementary for me to say, but it's the thing that I've always found unbelievable about your art.
Thank
you.
Is
that there's this rawness that feels very... Oh my God, there's lights just went off.
It's kind of nice, actually.
Yeah, it's
quite
nice.
It.
Okay, so that we also are in a vault. Do you know the history of this vault?
I do. Don't know so this hotel that we're staying at in Durham is called the 21C Museum Hotel, and I do believe it used to be a bank. And so the place that we are currently doing the interview is in the basement of the hotel in a literal bank vault where we can see the sort of lockers where money used to be kept. And the lights just went off for a moment, which is why we were giggling.
Yeah.
But to your point earlier about making music that's human, I really appreciate that. And I also really appreciated that you said that you felt like my personality is connected to the art and vice versa. And I was going to mention that when I was much younger, I would feel really free in myself when I was living in New York, and then when I went on to live in India. But when I came back to the States after living in India, I was 9 years old, and I was full of life, full of personality, full of self-confidence. And it was interesting because when I came back to go to this sort of all-girls private school on the Upper East Side of Manhattan for those 2 years, sixth and seventh grade, I remember being really badly bullied by the other girls. And that experience, you know, almost decades later, I still reflect on it as something that influenced me a lot and has developed my empathy to never want to be ever inaccessible or too cool or mean or too high art. I'm not interested in that because I knew what it was like to be on the other side of something that was exclusive. And so that's why I try my best to make the music, the feminism, the intention of it all very love energy driven and very human. And then the other thing I wanted to add quickly was a friend of mine who's also a Scorpio out in London. She's a rock and roller there. Her name is Charlie Jeffries. And she was telling me she read this message of, if you are friends with a musician or you know a musician or you're dating a musician, like, as soon as the show is over, do not talk about anything but the show. For the next hour afterwards. And then it was like, oh, scratch that, for the next 2 weeks afterwards. And I was laughing.
You have to analyze it.
For sure.
You have to break every single thing apart.
Because it's us. And that was the point that I wanted to make. Yeah. It's just so connected to us.
Yeah. Totally. And I love that you said that. I'm sorry to hear, though, obviously there's so much about moving to a new place, which I feel like we almost chatted about earlier. And, you know, feeling that pressure from people and feeling bullied. It's such a strange thing to go through when you're so young. You can fight for yourself, but not in the way that, you know, would be right for a bully. The bully's not going to stop. But how do you feel, not that it's informed the way that you are now, but going through it, can you even identify with that person now, who you were then?
I definitely can, because I feel like I go through phases of it, in the sense, or even like year-long phases of it, where I feel like my most top self, and then I feel like a rebirth where I'm starting over again, and then I feel, maybe I'm perceiving it or not, but I'll feel like I'm not my brightest, best self, and that I connect with that time. But it's interesting, but because I came out of it having, when I went through that phase, the thing that came out of it was, the thing that got me out of it was twofold. I had this teacher who was a Cancer and who really was so loving to me and just so encouraging of me. And that gave me a lot of self-worth. And I think of that time. Then I think the second thing that really helped me was just investing in my own skill sets and learning the drums and learning DJing, and then not needing external validation, but just knowing for myself that I was a cool kid because I was doing cool other things.
And escaping into that world.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
And drawing sort of self-worth from other sources instead of like, what shoes do I have? What bag do I have? The cool kid things to
do. The important things when you're younger.
So I think I remember those two lessons. Even to this day, even when I work with younger kids, you know, I go into the jail system to teach beat making to incarcerated youth twice a month in downtown LA. And when I mentor them, I'm always telling them the same thing. It's like, listen, as soon as you're back out, while you're in here, even, we're going to invest in our skill sets. We're going to learn DJing. We're going to learn beat making, because it can really bring you some joy.
I also think there's something about not only going into a craft when you're that age, but also learning something and then being very good at it. There's like two different, you know, it's a different thing. But I love how learning an instrument and or exploring that artistic self within you when you're so young, your brain and everything's forming whilst you're exploring it. So it's almost like this weave, you know, that's connecting. And I feel like that those younger years are so important to do it. It's not, and it's not like everybody has to learn an instrument when they're younger, but I also feel like coming out from having that adversity and dealing with, you know, issues at school,
it's not escapism as such as it is like empowerment, you know, although I can't stand that word at the moment, but you know, it's, I don't know why I've like got a funny thing about that word.
I know what you mean. Cause the word empowerment sounds like somebody else still has to give the person the power in order for them to feel 100%. Like they have power. I understand.
Thank you. Yeah, I haven't been able to like actually,
I use the word, but I do me understand too. That criticism. Yeah. It's a very good point. When I say I'm empowering the youth, it sounds like I'm the one with power when
giving
someone,
it to them.
Totally. Yeah. But I do think there can be a positive version of that, which is that when I analyze it through the lens of privilege, I often try to teach others that we're not here to feel guilty for our privilege. We're here to say, what privilege do I have? Mm-hmm. Let's be honest about these different kinds of privileges. And how do I use them for good?
Absolutely.
And so that's why in that context, I don't mind the word empower, because I do want folks, especially the men, you know, especially the straight folks in the context of the queer folks, especially folks who are Caucasian identifying in the context of the world of folks of color. How do you participate in a way that's actually really inclusive and really fun and positive?
And I think the word is also action. I feel like there's a lot that people feel so overwhelmed, like, I don't know what to do. I've got this privilege and I grew up in this system and I know more and I'm educated. And the truth is, like, there's so many tools that you can use.
Yeah, do something.
Just do something.
Totally.
But I feel like that conversation is so difficult to have sometimes when you do come from a privileged background. I feel like everybody who I've spoken to who's come from that, I feel like they can't necessarily... It's like the guilt is too much.
Yep, I relate to that.
So they can't, you know, even see how they can have a gentle conversation with somebody just to find out. And a question is good, right? Curiosity is the only way that we can connect.
Totally. And I think people are really afraid of their own peer group. So if a member of your peer group sees that you're trying to do something different or trying to make a difference, they tend to feel like it's a reflection of themselves. It's like when you tell somebody that you're vegetarian and they immediately feel defensive, or in your case, when you tell somebody you don't drink, they feel defensive. yeah, for sure. And we definitely relate to that, you know, people feel like they have to explain themselves when you are actually just sharing something about yourself. So it's a very similar dynamic. And I think people... we do have to do that work to say, listen, I'm not going to let somebody distract me. I'm going to be clear that I want to do something and I want to do something good. We tend to throw shade at each other's activism. We say, oh, well, you're only donating. You're only writing checks. Only tweeting. You're only volunteering. You only are making this organization so that you can benefit yourself. We love to criticize. And I don't subscribe to that. I do think it's safer to actually be validating each other and encouraging each other.
I feel very moved by that, what you just said, I have to say, because so often people are so quick to criticize sharing things on Facebook, and like, you can't share a petition on Facebook or you can't share something on Twitter. And even sometimes I get a bit defensive, like if somebody's sharing something about elephants in Africa, and I'm like, oh,
you know why that
American,
is it's
you know?
Because you know what it is, I think the reason actually why we do like to criticize each other's activism is because sometimes we question the other person's intention. I think that's really what it is. Is it genuine, or are you trying to get a pat on the back? And perhaps that's where criticism is a good balancing effect, because we want to encourage folks to do it for the right reason. We don't want to encourage folks to be doing activism to be considered, you know, cool in their community.
Exactly.
Or to feel like they can now sleep at night and that kind of thing. That's very, I think that is the wrong intention. So maybe that's why we're so quick to criticize each other's actions. And for us who are doing activist work, no matter what that looks like, I'm constantly asking myself, what's the intention? And, you know,
I love that.
Yeah.
That's such a, it's a very, I think that I haven't really broached the topic of intention that much, but I think in a kind of existential way I have, but not so direct like this. And it's such a beautiful, in Judaism, which is what I grew up with, there's the number three is really important. Because one, you're making a decision. Two, you really, really, if you're repeating that behavior, you've made the decision to repeat it. If you do it a third time, you really have the intention behind
that.
It. Wow. So when a bride gets married, when a woman gets married, you circle your partner.
Three times. I love that. I just got goosebumps. That's
and
beautiful.
Whether it's actually, it's not actually a woman. It could be both. Hmm. It could be man or a woman, depending on which sect, you know, if you're Orthodox or Reform.
Okay.
And I love intention and I love speaking about it in relation to art, especially because I feel like even being an activist as you are, your intention could be good, but then somebody who's writing a story about you or somebody who comes into contact with you might also not have that intention and then box you
into that. Yep.
So how have you managed to navigate that?
This is so perfect. We're flowing so well. The answer is consistency.
Yeah.
The answer is very simple. It's consistency. You just have to look at someone's track record. If tomorrow I decide to care about an issue inauthentically that I've never, ever talked about, never cared about, but I realize I personally, as some sort of artist, think it might get me more Instagram followers if I now participate in this random conversation, right? Because this is when we criticize folks for caring about feminism now that Me Too is culturally relevant. Mm-hmm. You know, when they've never cared about it. That's when people get criticism.
Yeah.
It's similar. It's if I noticed, oh my gosh, environmental justice is a hot button issue. Mm-hmm. And I know that if I post about it, I'm going to get more followers. That is a wrong intention to be posting about something because you are not genuinely trying to push the issue forward. You are trying to self-serve, and that's the problem. Consistency is the opposite effect. Consistency is like when folks were looking, you were doing it. When folks were not looking, you were doing it. You have a passion. You're motivated just by the actual work itself because it's rewarding. You know, when I work with the kids for an hour in the jail cell, it gives me so much energy. It gives me so much joy. It obviously, I also feel intensely sad at times afterwards,
of course,
depending on where I am, what phase of my cycle I am on also. But
or just a day. I mean, just a day. You spend their day.
For sure.
You don't know how you're going to meet anybody either.
Totally.
Where they're going to be at as well.
Yeah. So I think that's the real thing you have to look at is the consistency. Is has the person been doing that? And also, if you're an artist and someone writes a bad review about you or says something bad, you know, when I ran the London Marathon bleeding freely in 2015, the story went viral. And it was a really important lesson for me because I was so untouched by the negative. I was laughing the whole way through because it was such a bad, I was so personally proud of the run.
What was, can you tell me a little bit about it?
For sure. I remember being at the start line of the London Marathon and being on day one of my period unknowingly. I was just hoping I would get it later that week. And I had never run a marathon in my life, and let alone on the days of my cycle and my training, I would have just opted out and chilled that day. And I didn't want to quit the marathon, you know, but I legit didn't know. I was like, what happens? Do people run?
Yeah, what do you do?
So like many of us, you know, who have been caught unprepared on our cycle, I remember evaluating my options and I was like, well, a pad causes chafing. I don't have any kind of pad on me. I don't have a menstrual cup on me. I maybe a tampon, I suppose so. But I didn't want like a half in, half out situation for 4 hours. I didn't have an extra one either to like change out. There's no privacy on a marathon course. So I just remember being like, I'd rather bleed freely and just run and see what happens then. And I knew it was a punk rock move. Like bleeding freely from anywhere is like a punk rock move trying to run 26 miles.
Yeah.
But I ran.
Well, trying to run.
Period.
Is also.
Amen. Exactly. And so I remember just being like, fuck it, I'm going to do this. And I ran and I was like bleeding. It was awesome. And I crossed the finish line. And I was just so genuinely proud of my own body, of my own accomplishment, of having graduated. I had just graduated Harvard Business School. I had finished this tour.
I've heard that about you. That is insane.
I had just finished this tour with MIA. It was just like this amazingly powerful, emotional run. And I crossed the finish line and I wrote about this experience. And I wrote about it in the context of combating menstrual stigma. The fact that me running is such a radical thing, that me as a female and as a person who bleeds, prioritizing my own comfort in that moment is considered such a radical thing. The story went viral. And with all the negative was all the positive. But the interesting thing, I wanted to bring it back to the artist listening, is that that negative feedback would have destroyed me had the intention been inauthentic. But the intention of the run was so genuine and I was so proud of it. And I had owned the run because it wasn't supposed to be a virally engineered story. It wasn't even supposed to be
premeditated.
No, and it wasn't even supposed to be an activist act. It was just me trying to do what I would do. And my friends who know me, they're like, you would fucking run a marathon bleeding, then go and fucking put a tampon in. Like, we know you, and you would fucking do that, you know? So it felt real.
Yeah, and so that's the thing. Who you are.
And so if we do feel sensitive to something, if we do shut down because of what someone says to us, and I constantly am trying to feedback this work for myself, we have to ask ourselves, whoa, I'm really sensitive to that. That really struck a nerve. That art, that reviewer or that friend of mine or what that person just said really got me riled up. What's that work that I have to do? Why did I feel called out? Do you know what I mean?
Have you ever done a BWRT?
Is that the same as Myers-Briggs?
It's like, it's brain. I don't know what it stands for. I could probably Google if we weren't in a vault, but we were in a vault with no reception. BWRT is like brain reworking. It stands for brain reworking therapy, something therapy.
Is it kind of like hypnosis?
So, strangely enough, it is.
That makes sense.
Which I would never have ever.
I've definitely done some stuff like that. Yeah, for sure. Where we have like negative thought patterns that go through our minds over and over again. And our thoughts become. And you undo the. Exactly, for sure. And what we have to do is undo those negative thought patterns and rewire them, as you said, so that our positive thoughts then become our positive actions.
Especially when you are creating, when you have that self-doubt and or you have that work. You're already doing all of that work in terms of the craft, and then you also need to do it in terms of your personal relationship so that that can hopefully
translate,
affect it.
Yeah.
And then weirdly, what I'd never heard of it, and I work with I can't call her therapist because she's more of a coach.
Life coach, mentor.
You know what I'd like to call her is a facilitator. So what she does is essentially she works with heart math. I don't know if you've, and I have asthma, and heart math is amazing when you're breathing. It's not meditation, it's almost energizing. Because meditation sometimes makes me a bit sleepy, and I actually need
to be energized.
Yeah, because I don't drink and have caffeine and things like that, so I feel low energy a lot. And BWRT, weirdly, it shifted so much of my work thing. I thought I was going to do it for personal shit that was going on in my life, and it weirdly helped in the work aspect in terms of creating, because that negative it's a switch. And what BWRT does is that it takes the charge out of stuff. And I feel like that's, and again, going back to what we're talking about, if you take the charge out of things, sometimes things that are so heightened, things that really make you feel awful, you can then have that air to create.
I love
and
that.
Be clearer.
It's so true. And my best friend is always reminding me of that. She's like, dude, like where you put your energy is like what your reality is.
But I never understood when people said that to me, because my energy was everywhere, because that's how I connect. And I like to feel things and touch things and see things and do things. And weirdly, when you take a charge out of the thing, it's not that it is less important, which I find sometimes when you put your energy to something, or if you don't put your energy to something, it's choosing where your priorities are. And I feel like taking a charge out of negativity doesn't, it just puts it into a box and then you can move on from it. And I can't even imagine as an artist in this world that we are in now. So how do you feel like you've been able to deal with that as well, in terms, because I know your future is female, that's a huge thing for you, and that slogan is so important for me, but how do you feel like you've dealt with being, making sure that you're really talking about everybody?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's kind of like when we say Black Lives Matter and they come at us with that All Lives Matter rhetoric. It's like, well, listen, you know, not all lives are being mass incarcerated and gunned down in this country, so we have to say Black Lives Matter. We have to remind you until that work is no longer necessary. It's like, you know, it's like when we say save the dolphins, it doesn't mean kill the whales. And so when we say the future is female, it's about valuing femininity and feminine energy in all of us, regardless of what our gender identity is. And moreover, it's about saying how do we value emotional intelligence instead of this sort of brute force aggression that we've seen, at least with this president in the fucking White House and with, you know, CEO styles of leadership? Yeah. What if instead we said we would be prioritizing collaboration instead of competitiveness? What if we were linked and not ranked? You know, we assumed that we were all bringing something to the table equally instead of this hierarchy mentality that we have. And so understanding what my feminism even is, and knowing inward what it is, I definitely think that's a big theme in our podcast discussion today at large, is what is the intention? What is the intention? And I am very clear that my feminism is this belief that what feminine energy has to offer is healing for all people. It's leading with love. It's leading with compassion. It's leading with peacefulness. It's leading with that sort of heightened sense of self-awareness and intelligence that I try my best to carry with in the world. And that's why I love this phrase, the future is female. It's aspirational. It's saying, wow, when our systems that are very aggressive and led from the masculine have often worked for us, but also sometimes fail for us and fail for many people, how do we have an alternative? And so that's why it's easy for me to have a feminism that I believe is accessible for all types of people, regardless of their gender identity, their sexual orientation, their race, their sort of ability in this world, because it's really leading from love.
So did you move from, were you born in America?
Yes.
And then you went back?
Yes.
And then you came back?
Yes.
Okay. So when you came back, did your interest in music shift into where you thought, into things that you thought you should listen to, or what was around you at the time? Like, how much? Because I almost want to, I wish I could take one of those like Harry Potter spells and go back
in
into
time.
Your life.
Such a cool
yours
question.
Specifically, just to hear what was playing,
I love
you
that.
Know, around you at the time.
I definitely remember loving music when I was young and being in India, but it was really after that experience having been bullied in middle school when I actually felt empowered to just play it myself instead of going to consume other people's music. I was drumming, I was DJing, I was playing bongos, congas, any kind of percussion I can get my hands on. I was just learning all the patterns.
Why did you think you went to that? Sorry to interrupt.
I think I understood the sort of tomboy rebelliousness of it. I think I knew the drums were just fucking cool. Yeah. I went to an all-girls school too, so we would always be taught. It was still retro, even for how feminist it was also retro in a way, because we had to wear skirts and we had to play the flute and we learned how to play violin and we all had to learn how to sing, and we also, you know, it was fucking the middle 2000s, but still we were learning these rather quote-unquote appropriate for girls type instruments. And while we did have djembes in school, while there was some percussion, there wasn't like a house drum kit the way you might have in a co-ed school in the dusty closet somewhere. I remember as a
kid, such a masculine, I never thought of how masculine a drum kit is, but you're so right.
Yeah,
the action of it, everything.
Yeah,
your legs are open.
Yeah,
you got just, you know, you got everything's true. In the middle.
Yeah, it's true.
I never thought about how, I thought about the act of being it's aggressive and it's physical, but I never thought of it being masculine.
Yeah, you make a good point. It's true, and I think that's how we understand it in our culture, that the men are better at it just because of anatomy or whatever. But that's the thing, is that we can't teach women to aspire to what the men are doing. We have to give these kinds of, you know, and we're at Moog Fest 2019. This is something that I'm talking about a lot during my workshops here, about giving analog synthesizers and like heavy, big modular synths and drum sets and things like that to folks who don't traditionally play those instruments, because not because we're trying to force them to play like the older white men who tend to play those instruments, but to just play like themselves. What does it sound like if I give my DJ rig to a 12-year-old young black girl in the incarcerated center in downtown LA? She did an amazing job. But those native instruments, you know, tractor controllers tend to be played by skinny white dudes from Berlin. Like, that's the look, you know? And so the beauty of the juxtaposition and seeing what someone who's never played that instrument can do is amazing. I mean, think of the reverse of it. Think of the colonizer mentality. When you had all the white dudes going to India to learn sitar and then bringing it back, started a movement in the 60s and 70s of hippie culture and listening to psychedelic music. And it was wonderful. So imagine if we flip that theory on its head.
Do you think though that learning how to, because in, I as a as I write about it, I'm on the other side of you, and I've never wanted to be a musician, but I always thought that learning an instrument was a huge gift, and I wanted to. So when I was like 18, I learned the drums. Wow. I got back from London and I was like, oh, I wanted, my dad played the drums and he would also finger drum on his like steering awesome. Wheel. So it was like a really sweet memory that I have. But there's something different about playing the drums that I think a lot of people don't tap into.
Yes.
And especially, I love thinking about the placement of where a drummer is that you're in the middle, you're in the back most of the time, and you're in the middle, so you can see your bassist, you can see your guitarist, you can see your lead singer, usually in the traditional setup. And I love that people don't really take notice. And you've just got this roar coming from the back. And I almost love that the drummer is placed there, because they are at the back, but they are also kind of in the front because they're driving everything. So do you feel like when you started playing drums for, you know, you were with, as you said, you were with MIA, and who else did you play drums with? I mean, there's so many... You've collaborated with so many people.
Yeah, for TV on the Radio, for Thievery Corporation.
Oh, Thievery Corporation. Yeah. Sorry, and TV on the Radio is, yeah. I'm like, I can't believe I'm scratching. I'm like physically having a reaction.
They're the best.
They really are.
It's about making your heroes your friends. I forgot to answer your question earlier about what was playing when I was young, yes. But I was listening to Thievery Corporation and TV on the Radio.
How
so
great was Thievery
decades
Corporation?
Later. I mean, the best, the best. And decades later, they're my friends. Tunde, who's the head of TV on the, you know, the lead singer, he was just taking a photo of wearing my merch. As a 18-year-old, I would wear his, you know. It's so full circle. But yeah, I've played for them. I've played for Lizzo. I've played for Kehlani. I've played for Amber Kaufman, who was in the Dirty Projectors for many years. Yeah, just wonderful, wonderful folks who are my heroes, you know.
How is it then to play
solo? Is that what you're gonna ask?
Not necessarily. I feel like I was more gonna ask, because you have never felt like part of a band as such.
True.
So I was going to ask, how do you lend your identity to somebody else's? Because you mentioned all these bands. I mean, my brain works in pictures, but you have a visual. The minute you think of TV on the Radio, yep. Wolf Like Me and Return to Cookie Mountain, you think Dirty Projectors.
I mean, yep.
Crazy. And then you think, you have the visceral reactions to all these bands that were so formative in our lives when we were younger. But how did you navigate putting your identity to bands that had their own?
I think that's a wonderful question. I think the answer is baked into what you said, is having an identity. Like when you think of Madame Gandhi, you think yellow hair, you think wild, like curly hair, you think drums, you think percussion, you think cowbells, you think funky, you think colorful, feminist, political, all of those different things. Future is female, yellow, you know, and I think knowing exactly what your identity is and then being able to see, like, how do I modify that so it fits the persona of TV on the Radio, so that it fits the persona of MIA, so that it fits the persona of Kehlani, you just make the Venn diagram of the overlapping similarities very connected. And TV on the Radio, you know, they were so supportive of my work for years, just because they're very open, political, all Pisces dudes.
Kip.
They're all Kip crazy? And Tunde, the main dudes. They're my dear friends, and they're both Pisces, you know, and we talk about that a lot. And so that's really the best way. And I think you had asked me something earlier that I wanted to answer too, which was about, oh yeah, just about the drummer being in the back. It is true. So I think I've liked the role of being able to support and like pop into what other people are doing in a collaborative way. But for my project, the drums are right front and center, and there's percussion on the stage, and there's yellow shakers everywhere, and the drums are yellow and the percussion is yellow. And today at Moog Fest, I hosted what I called like the Gandhi Own Your Voice jam session.
Yes, tell me.
And the format
that
was super cool. I had like a U shape of tables, and then I had a bunch of different synthesizers and Ableton Live rigs and sensory percussion and triggers all set up on the tables. And then I put my drum set right in the center, so that it was very clear that the drums of this particular jam were sort of the leader, and also using that leadership role to elevate others, to encourage folks to swap in and out of the different synths, to notice when someone was soloing and give them that encouragement, and then also encourage them to wind down to let the next person solo. So I had a mic at the drums, and I was playing the drum set, and really kind of showing the drums in a different leadership light.
How did you feel like they, how was the crowd?
It was wonderful. They loved it. Because people, especially as we get older, we are sort of socialized to dim our light and to kind of quiet ourselves. So simultaneously, it's like two things are going on. Mm. One, holistically, men, women, all of us, every gender in between, we're taught to dim our light. Mm. But at the same time, when you have a mixture of genders, the men tend to be more alpha because from a younger age, they are socialized to take more risk than the women. Mm-hmm. And so then they don't mind hopping on the mic. They don't mind playing instruments they've never even seen in their whole life. Whereas mm-hmm. the women, if they see an instrument they've never seen in their whole life, they definitely immediately assume that they're not qualified to play it. Whereas it's just a fucking button. And the men are just playing all types of dumb buttons.
I also think women are like, I'm not going to try something if I look like a fucking idiot.
And that was the purpose of the experiment too. Yeah. I said, you know, many of us are making electronic music by ourselves because there's so many ugly, quote unquote, ugly sounds that have to be made before you unlock the gems. And even for me with my singing, I'm singing all types of wrong notes just to get the idea out before I hit the right notes. And so what does it feel like to practice that bravery in front of other people and to practice embodying a safe space? So like if you notice somebody else is making some crazy sounds next to you, don't walk away from them. Be open with them. Encourage them. Let them find and land on that interesting patch.
It's so awkward for people if they're not tapping into that already. Exactly. You know, so you putting them, and obviously putting somebody into an uncomfortable position is crucial for change, which is crucial for vulnerability, which is crucial for courage, like all of those things.
Exactly. And we have to teach that bravery and not perfection, you know. And I think a lot of women, we don't put ourselves in the mix until we're literally like the number one violin player in the whole fucking planet. Then we think we're qualified.
I love saying this. I've struggled with that my whole life, is that I would never let anybody see anything I wrote until it was at its best point, which, as you know, as a writer yourself, as an artist yourself, how can you wait until that time?
Totally. It doesn't exist. Also, because once you've like quote unquote arrived, you're already another version of yourself.
100%.
And that's also part of this notion of bravery, not perfection. Like, I think part of the Madame Gandhi mission is very meta. Like, I don't sit on things for years and years and years. As soon as something's done, I fucking put it out because I want the next generation of kids to be like, oh, what? Like, she's brown, she's queer, she's Indian, she's female, and she's putting out this music, and I can make fucking better music. That's what we want. You know, we want other people to see that it's easy and that it's doable and that like there's no backlash and that it's needed. That's what I want folks to see.
Then what is the thing that they haven't seen yet?
I think I think for my project, I think there's a lot of independence. I think I take a lot of roles in my own project. There's not this mentality that I'm waiting for funding, that I'm waiting for a press, that I'm waiting for a blog to care, I'm waiting for Spotify to playlist me. I made my own fucking playlist, grew it to 5,000 people, and now I'm not only do I playlist myself, I playlist all of the young up and coming femme-identifying artists who would never get playlisting on Spotify otherwise and are so grateful that their song is debuting on the Madame Gandhi Futures Female Playlist. And they'll come to my talks and say, hi, Kieran, I made you this. It's a gift because 6 months ago, you were the first person who ever like playlisted me. Thank you so much. Yeah. And that's it. Like, we're not here waiting for the white men to eventually, quote unquote, let us find in. Us, I'm not interested. Yeah. I don't even want to participate in what they're doing. I want to do our own thing. Obviously, Spotify, you know, and all these tech platforms, we're very grateful for the infrastructures they're building for tech leading, you know, music and taking us into the next era. There's always eternal gratitude, but most of the time with that power, those folks don't necessarily take the responsibility and take everybody with them on the journey. Many folks get left behind, so it's about being self-aware. How do I be part of the change? How do I be proactive about the change instead of desperately trying to get onto somebody else's fucking playlist?
And also, the change is happening now because we know that Spotify could also end tomorrow, and then everybody's playlists and library curation
doesn't matter. Exactly.
So I love that concept of putting something out immediately, because you are, the trajectory of who you are from creation to putting it out, it shifts so and drastically.
I talk to a lot of creators too. I say that song is just a timestamp of your emotions in that moment. And so for me, the times that I've had to wait a long time for somebody else to help me like finish out a song or for me myself to get it together to finish it out, you're bored of that song a year later, or the feelings are not as relevant. So the best is to try to create quickly around the time of inspiration and pushing that concept one moment further it's also about us investing in our own skill sets so that we can have the tools that we need to finish the song. Mm-hmm. Most folks are depending on other producers, other technicians, other engineers to help them finish the music. Fuck that. We have to teach ourselves. Mm-hmm. Get a laptop. Learn how to use an audio interface. Learn how to mic yourself, because mm-hmm. then we're not waiting around. We're just doing it.
Mm-hmm. But the act of just doing something
is a solo act. It's not collaborative.
Yeah.
So about that, it's kind of like, collaboration to me needs to feel like both people are bringing equal skill sets to the table. Mm-hmm. And if we as women and femmes and folks in this sort of minority don't feel like we have enough power and self and knowledge to mm-hmm. have an equal collaboration, you end up being vulnerable to exploitation. The mm-hmm. amount of times that I've heard my friends say, damn, I have to pay this producer so much money to finish my song. Oh my God, we got into a fight and now my stems are trapped in their mm-hmm. laptop and I can't get my stems to my own song back.
I also think that people need sometimes a pat on the back or a push, which is totally fine being a creative, right? You sometimes do need somebody to push you into the direction. So yes, you need that empowerment to do it yourself and just release it, but sometimes you do need a bit of a handhold to get there, especially folks who feel that they have, you know, been bullied out of something or shoved aside or stepped over. So I really like that both work. It's not less empowering.
I think the difference is if you don't know anything about production, if you don't know anything about melodies, if you don't, like, I don't know anything about chords, for example. So if I don't know anything about chords or about music theory, and I'm on my journey, but let's just, like, I pretty much know very little. So that puts me already in a vulnerable position if I'm telling somebody, hey, I need you to play something that sounds happy, because they're going to play that interpretation of that, and I'm grateful. But it's definitely a more empowered position for me to say, hey, I would love to try an E major chord here so that it sounds bright and I know what I'm hearing in my head, and maybe I don't have the dexterity in my fingertips to play it on the piano. They do. So I just, it's just kind of that. It's like, then you're at least in an empowered leadership position and saying, hey, I don't know how to do this, but I know what I need you to do. You're still in the position of leadership. It's like when a CEO is like, hey, I don't know how to actually do the, like, data analysis on the actual NASA like flight, you know what I mean? But I know what needs to get done, and this is what needs to get done. It's sort of that mentality, whereas if I come in and I don't know anything, it's just going to be whatever they say, because I'm in this sort of more vulnerable position. So that's sort of the nuanced difference that I was describing. The more we know, the more we come in with confidence than with sort of a disempowered position, because I've experienced both.
Where are you now in terms of creating, like, how I don't even want to ask you about your process, because I'm sure it changes all the time. But where are you now in terms of...
Well, I began producing in 2014, so it's 2019. So I've been in 5 years Ableton producer. And I think the way I tend to do things is, like, I love to sketch out the concept for the song and get it as far as possible on my own, and then either just finish the song on my own and be like, cool, I love how it is solo, it's fire, or, like, get a homie, like my friend Opal, she'll come and, like, lay in some keys, or my other friend Anetta, she's, like, amazing Russian flute player, she kills it on the flute, or you know, my other friend in Montreal, she played a bunch of sax on my stuff, we're always sending files back and forth. So that's, like, one way. Or in the case of my other song, Bad Habits, or Top Knot Turn Up, where there was somebody else's sound that I loved, I got the the sort of rough sketch of the sounds that I wanted, but, like, put in some really shitty, like, Ableton drums as, like, a placeholder. So it literally sounds like goo-ga, like, it sounds like bad tinny computer music, like tinny and, like, terrible. But just, I needed to just get the idea down, because I was like, I'm not gonna use this. And then I didn't really know how to write the right African inspired Nigerian kind of bass line that I needed it to be done well. And so there was a couple of things that I was very self-aware, like, somebody else is gonna be more equipped for this job. And also arranging, sometimes, you know, like, I don't know if I want this to be more instrumental or more, like, poppy or whatever. So for Bad Habits, I got it as far as I could. And then I kind of, like, talked to the universe, and I was like, I don't know who's going to finish this song, but it's not me. And I don't know the person yet. I didn't have anybody in my immediate mind. And then I went to South by Southwest, and I met this young queer producer from Dallas named Zach Witness, who had done the last Erykah Badu record, produced it start to finish in his fucking mom's house and did it. And I was like, this is the kind of person I want to work with. He's humble. He's gifted. gifted, he's smart, he's funny, he's a cool dude. And we just spent like 2 weeks hanging out in LA and finishing this song together. So that's kind of like what, like one, the two main ways I do things. Either I'm making stuff solo by myself and finishing it solo, and I like the feeling of that. I have a vision. Other times I'm like, yo, this, I'm like trying to achieve a certain sound that's not my own, so let me collaborate.
At least you know that it's not your own.
Yeah.
I feel like that's a huge, it's a huge gift to know where you are needed and your you know, where, what you can give agency and what you can take away. Because I feel like empowering those around you is doing that. You know what I mean?
Totally.
So especially with your music. So when you were in school and then you created your own music because you just, everything that you were hearing, you wanted to create it yourself. So then when did you start performing? Was it as a drummer, or did you find that later?
I was always drumming for other people. When I was at Harvard, after I had worked at Interscope, I was drumming for MIA. When the menstrual marathon story went viral in 2015, I would be asked to public speak all over the world. And I was doing that. It was very, very powerful time in my life and very impactful. And then folks would say, oh, cool, and you're a musician, like play us a couple tunes. And I'd be like, yo, yeah, like I just know how to drum for other people. Yeah, like I don't have my own music. And a mentor of mine was like, dude, you better fucking make some music, because you're in a lucky position. You're in the opposite. It's like you don't even have music. People want to hear your music. Most of the time it's the opposite.
Yeah,
you need, they're begging people to listen to your music. So it was just really a blessing where I would just start doing things. And the one time, I remember, it was this Planned Parenthood big fundraiser in 2015 fall, a couple months after my story had gone viral, and I was asked to headline the fundraiser. I didn't have any music, but I just put together like a random half an hour quote-unquote Madam Gandhi show, which was like me playing covers of like MIA songs and then like two of my own beats, and then like a long percussion jam with two other female instrumentalists on the stage. You know what I mean? Like it's this notion that we've talked about in the podcast. You have to fail forward. Like, I didn't care if that show was terrible. I used it as a reason to have to put together something so that I just would start.
I don't know. I can't even use the word inspiring, because it's so far beyond that. It's moving. Like there's motion in what you've done. And I feel like it's so rare to meet somebody who takes that. It's not even a risk. It's the necessity to have to keep moving forward. You have to keep creating.
That's
and you have
it.
To work through all of that.
And you know what I think we as musicians and creators forget, and I think it was like traveling as a kid that really taught me this skill set, is like sometimes we forget that most people are not musicians. If it's a show, it'll be a fucking show. They don't care whether you're the one singing the songs or that it's like you're a music. Think about a DJ. A DJ is playing all other people's music, and we have multi-million-dollar industries around just DJing, where people are playing Vegas and smoke and lights and fire and all this shit. They're literally they're mixing all their fucking people's music. Can you imagine millions of dollars these people make?
Amazing.
Of course, they're producing their own music as well, many of them. But the point is that when I was doing that 2015 show, I just remembered, most of these folks are not musicians. No one is sitting there criticizing me more than I would probably be criticizing myself. And so having that really clear sense of awareness is so important, because as long as I'm having a good ass time, they're gonna have a good ass time. And so that's really the mentality of failing forward. And listen, I've had terrible shows. I've had terrible shows. For every terrible show, you get the amazing shows. How else can you learn?
Do you know that it's terrible?
It's my feeling that I didn't connect with the audience, or that I was singing off key, or that the show, many people didn't come, so that I'm performing for fewer people, which I don't like. I tend to fail in that environment. I tend to do much better when there's way more people, because then I'm feeding off of their energy, you know?
Is that because just the intimacy of having like a big room that's meant to fit a lot of people and one or two faces,
It's that I rely on the audience to participate, and audiences feel more safe to participate if they feel
in
like
numbers.
They're one in like a huge sea of people, because then they feel more protected. If it's just like eight of them and they're like sort of in the back of the bar, front, then they don't feel as brave to participate. So then it's like double work on me to bring them closer or beg them to come to front. We have all types of tricks designed in a Madam Gandhi show. Like, for example, we pass out stickers like in the second or third track of the show, because it forces people to rush to the front because they want to get free whatever. And now we have the entire group of people pushed up to the front instead of doing that awkward sort of American thing where everyone's like halfway through. Halfway back the venue. Because people don't, they either think it's too eager to be in the front, or they think it's embarrassing, or they think they might block somebody else's view, or they don't want to be too visible. I mean, my girlfriend is here. She can tell us why she doesn't like to be in the front row. We can learn something about the psychology of that. But it's very, you know, it's just a very normal thing.
Why don't you like being in the front?
I don't like being the center of attention at Karen's or Madame Gandhi's show.
You're putting her on the microphone.
I definitely
do not like it.
This is very uncomfortable. But Madame Gandhi definitely pushes you out of your comfort zone, so this is definitely key. I'd rather sit in the back, or walls and corners are my best friends.
Totally. And also, do you feel like you have a better view because you're comfortable? Like, I sometimes, even if I'm in the front row and I can see everything and I'm uncomfortable, it's like my eyes just don't want to work. Like, I can't see anything. I can't take anything in. So do you feel like you're almost more comfortable and can see more when you are standing
at
in the back?
I feel like I do feel more comfortable in the back, away from like any center of attention.
Yeah. But how do you, I mean, that's not a bad thing, right? It's just different because...
It's a different point of view.
It's a different point of view. Exactly. Do you like the shows where you feel like you're surrounded by people, or is it you retreating to a place that's safe where like you can leave or go as you please?
The latter. Retreating to a place where I feel safe.
I think that's, I don't know, I think it's wonderful. I struggle because sometimes I have to get up close with my camera, so I've got to be like right under your nose, and unfortunately that's sometimes really uncomfortable because sometimes when you put yourself in that position, you are the center of attention. And it's not great because you just want to work or watch. So I totally relate to that completely. And I feel like there's a lot of shit that's given to people who are like in the corner, in the dark. You know? I feel like that happens sometimes.
It's true. I mean, I feel comfortable in the back, so I don't care.
you don't mind.
Yeah. I don't mind.
The only issue is if we're both in the audience of the other of a show.
Okay.
And I want to be in the front row and she wants to be in the back.
Oh my God.
And so then it's a give and take.
She goes in the front and I go in the back.
Well, that's not what I want either. I don't want me in the front and her in the back. So, I want to go to a show with my girlfriend and watch the fucking show.
Do you feel bad though standing at the back when you want to and you're just doing it to make yourself feel.
No, I feel fucking annoyed. It's part of the work that we have to do.
Guys, no, I'm married and that is what we go through. So it's not the work because you are where you are. It's just constant.
I'm just like, we're going to a show. Like, it's kind of like, this is my comfort zone.
Yeah.
So let me like you're not comfortable whether you're in the back or the front, really. Like, let's call it a spade a spade. Like, even Michelle in the beginning, I used to date Michelle and beg her to come to my show. She wouldn't fucking come to my shows. It would make me cry. I would be telling my friends, I'm like, I really like this person, but like, she won't even come to my damn show. I'm a fucking full-time musician.
You're so lucky to have that. I'm telling you, if you had anything other than that,
no, it wouldn't work.
A wreck.
No, it wouldn't work. Yeah. Like, your love has to come to your show because that's your like main, that's like your self-expression. That's like, if they don't like your art, they don't like you. It's like the worst thing ever. It feels
but
like
I don't
sucks.
Think that even means, I think that having somebody who has that individuality against somebody who's got such a high profile,
very important
public,
it's true,
persona,
it's
is
true.
Really important.
I see what you're saying. I thought you were saying liking the art versus not.
Oh,
no, you're absolutely right.
I feel like there's something really powerful about like you not even wanting to go if it's not going to make you feel no, but really,
I know what you're saying, but also I'm like,
we need to get like a cutout figure of you and just like hold it in the crowd so that she can see your face.
No, that's not it, guys. You want her to want to love your music. Like, I want her to want to come on her own volition.
She does. It's just the format of it. The format.
I do love your music and I sing and I do know every single word.
Because I feel like I have both. I've got, sometimes I can be in the front and be okay, and sometimes I'm much better off at the back. But I hate, also, I need glasses and I wear glasses sometimes. So, oh my God, guys, what happened?
It's just cute. You're like, so I just have a very... It was just cute because you were like, I just have a very practical reason as to why I need to stand in the front row. It's really nothing more than just basic pragmatism.
No, it's true though. But also because I, and you know, I don't know if this, if you'll relate to this, but I also think coming from where I come from, we didn't get, maybe you will, I think both of you probably will, but you didn't, it's not like in America, you get any band you ever want. Any time of the day, any place you want to go, you know, like even if this town is small, there's going to be a gigantic act coming through. Living in South Africa, you get like Lady Gaga, or like the first concert I ever saw was like Michael Jackson. You know what I mean? Like, and people are like, oh, that's so cool. And it's like, no, no, no. If it would be cooler if a smaller or indie artist came. And I feel like when there is a show that I know if I was younger, I would look into the future and go, fuck, I can't believe you're there. You know, it still means a lot to me. So when he stands at the back, and I want to go forward, I also need to validate how far I've come as well, if that makes sense.
It does, totally.
It's sometimes much...
It's like enjoying it because you can, because the little version of you didn't have that.
The novelty is not gone.
It's true, I love that. You know? I think that's so true, I relate to that. And I think when I used to live in India, my first concert ever, I was a third grader, and my first concert was in Mumbai, India, because my parents were friends with the CEO of India, Pepsi.
Okay.
And Pepsi was sponsoring Savage Garden to come to India. And so they knew that I loved dancing and singing. And they, my mom is fucking amazing, and said, she told my dad to not come with her and that she was gonna take me instead. Wow. Because she knew that I would love it, because my dad was like, Savage who, Savage what, like I don't even want to go out, you know, to the show. And my mom was like, let me take little Kiran because she will love it. And I heard that it was Savage Garden, I was screaming, I was so happy. My dad's like, who even are they? And they're like these two Australian, like queerish kind of dudes, 90s boys. And I loved them. And so I took my mom, and then because they saw that I was a kid, they were like, let's bring her backstage. So I met them. So anyway, I definitely relate though to this notion of the only acts that go to the big, to the cities, like places in India, like South Africa, are only the corporate sponsored big
the
events. And it feels, it's not the coolest thing. As a kid, obviously I was so thrilled to go, but it wasn't like we were going to music every day the way I was in New York City, where every band was coming through when I was 16 17 18, and that was a culture.
I love that was your first concert, because I've heard, I don't know what episode I'm on now, but I've heard the best concerts, like the people throwing out these names and you're like, what the fuck? And I've spoken to people who've been in the industry as well for decades. So you're talking about like people who saw Paul McCartney, or saw the Beatles, or saw these things. Or like I spoke to, do you know Anjali Kidjo?
Yeah, I love her.
She was my last guest.
Wow.
And her first was Miriam Makeba.
Oh, rude.
Who is my favorite. Wow. And I couldn't believe that was her first.
That's
and
amazing.
I feel like yours is similar to that, because I love Savage Garden. And I feel like they were big, but they were not like
the main.
They weren't
it's true.
The main.
It's
true. There's something about them that was
they had a
so
nuance.
Personal.
Yeah, it's so
you know?
True. It's so true.
When you went to that concert, did you have that feeling that was something you were going to do? Like, when was the time?
I did. Because I loved it so much, and it made me so happy. And every time, and I was always a fan, and to this day, like when I love, it's like either I basically have only two modes. Like, I'm either completely obsessed with something and like I'll tell everybody about it.
Yeah.
Or and then the opposite is not that I hate the thing. I'm just indifferent to it. Like if I'm indifferent to something, it's probably terrible, because when I love something, I just love it so much. I'm like, you need to try this. It's a date, and it's the best date you'll ever have, and it's from the desert and it's amazing. Or like forcing Michelle. Like, Michelle used to drink like boring ass black coffee and like think I was so weird. Now I've got her hooked on iced almond milk latte. Take three times a day in Los Angeles because it's the best coffee you'll ever drink. And so it's just little things like that. And so I think when I go to shows, and I am almost as a 30-year-old feeling a little sad, like nostalgic as you're describing, because I want to be a fan of someone again. Like, I need to be a fan of someone. I don't feel like there's anyone who I'm like, I'm obsessed with you and I can't wait to see your show of yours.
What was the first concert then, like the Savage Garden, that you saw and you were like, I'm a total fan, you are an icon?
Yeah.
This blew my mind.
It was when I saw Thievery Corporation for the first of what would become like at least 12 times that I saw them live. And then I ended up playing, I ended up serving as their percussionist for their 2010 Bonnaroo show. And then when I saw TV on the Radio live for the first time, I just cried. And then I saw them so many times after that. And then last year played percussion for them at their Queens Knockdown show where they re-performed Dear Science from start to finish. I know. And so
it's very special.
It's very special. And so it was those bands are definitely the ones. And I used to bring signs to shows. Talk about like not being in the front row. Like I would not only be in the front row, I'd be in the front row with a sign.
So handwritten or
hand-painted? I would always make hand-painted signs because I wanted to be noticed. Yeah. Like it was like the exact opposite strategy. Like not only was I in the front row, like I wanted to have an interaction with my favorite artist.
So you're like a flag holder person.
Yeah, it was like a flag. Yeah, holds the flag. But I think also the Pisces like empath in me as a performer, I wanted to be the fan that like let them know how much they meant to me because I intuitively understood that that would add value to them.
Yeah,
like I didn't feel like I was sucking their energy. I was actually like, don't worry, I got you. Like I'm showing you love because I know how much me being encouraging and excited about you it's makes you feel happy. You. Yeah.
Do you see signs now when you perform?
I've never seen a sign at a Madame Gandhi show, but like fans have done really fun, interesting things. Like I crowd surfed when I was in Denmark. That was my first time crowd surfing at a show, which was really, really sick. It was Roskilde, actually.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
When did you play Roskilde?
2017.
Oh my gosh, when was I there? 26, I think that is the most gigantic festival I've ever covered. I was there, I think 2016. Yeah, Neil Young played. Who played when you were there?
I mean, a million fucking people. God, so many.
That was a strange festival, though. I just remember people peeing everywhere.
Like, it's just a very normal. People, that's true. The Copenhagen, you know, the Denmark.
They just pee everywhere.
Yeah, it's very liberated that way.
Yeah. And then lastly, I think I wanted to just find out, in terms of moving forward with Futures Female and empowering others and working with, you know, kids, how do you feel your art is going to shift now that the more people you work with, I'm sure you are experiencing more and you're growing every day. How do you feel like that's going to affect your art going forward?
I think it only makes the art more interesting and complex. I think my perspective as an artist is oftentimes a little bit different. Like, it's not like I grew up as a singer and then at 17 I was signed and then matched with all the producers. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I think there's something powerful about having years on this earth and experiences with so many different types of people and cultures. And the fact that the music was actually always just a auxiliary vehicle for the message. Like, I think it's the message that motivates me more than anything. But it's then taking something that I enjoy doing, like playing the drums, like making beats, like singing, like public speaking, and using those gifts as a means to share this message. That's really how I think about it. And that's also how I teach people as well. I'm like, we're not asking you to suffer doing social justice work. Like, I don't subscribe to that. Obviously, we have to make sacrifices. That's one thing. But I'm talking about, like, what's your fuel to make a difference on this earth? What is the thing that you will always be doing anyway, and how can you use it for good? I mean, Michelle is a boxer. She's going to be boxing and being athletic for the rest of her life, no matter what. And she really wants to take that and teach young women who are often taught at the age of 17, here's how to be beautiful, here's how to be sexually consumable, here's how to be demure and not own your voice. And she wants to teach them, here's how to run.
Yeah.
Here's how to lace up your shoes and putting some boxing gloves and build up your confidence in the gym so that when you leave the walls of the
you're
gym
strong.
You have the power to deal with the bullshit that the world has waiting for you. This is the kind of thing that we're trying to encourage people to do. We don't care what it is that your medium is. I don't teach other people, be a feminist, be a musician. No. What are you already doing? What do you already love to do, and what do you care about? Bring the two together. So I think it's just more of the same, I suppose, and more of the same of embodying that change for other people.
I think that's a great way to end. Although I probably could talk to you forever.
I know.
Thank you so much.
Such a pleasure.
And it was just so wonderful having you both here. Can you
special guest
Can
fighting
you
Frankie.
Special guest.
Featuring.
Goodbye.
Yeah, the bottle fell. That was a great action.
Yeah.
But thank you
again. Thank you so much, Lior.
And how can people find you?
Please do stay in touch on Madame Gandhi social media. I think the best is Instagram. I love keeping my Instagram alive. I'm touring internationally this year. Hopefully, we'll be back in Scandinavia as well as India, Indonesia, London, Ibiza. All these wonderful trips are coming up, which is pretty cool. So stay in touch there. And then stream the music on Spotify. Mm-hmm. The new album comes out in June. It's called Visions. It's definitely about sort of building this brighter world, both in my own personal relations, but also in the real world. And then follow the Futurist Female playlist. Every Wednesday we update it with new emerging artists who are making big changes.
And that's on Spotify.
On Spotify.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Namaste.
This Must Be the Gig is produced by Adam Kibble, and we'd like to thank Billy Yost and The Kickback for our theme song, Rube, and buy their music at thekickbackband.com. Lexi Frame for the artwork, Daniel Brater and Dean Berger for the additional sound design, and the Consequence Podcast Network, where you'll find a bunch of other amazing shows. Hey! If you've listened this far, why not go the extra mile and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your podcasts? Your comments provide valuable feedback for us, and it helps other people find us too. For information on new episodes, be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at TMBTGpod, and generally just irritate everyone you know about the show. Thanks again. It's your way.
Consequence Podcast Network.